You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Yesterday, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change opened its conference in Copenhagen, and over the next 2 weeks, 15,000 delegates will gather to discuss the challenges of addressing climate change. Joining me now for an overview of the conference is Brian Walsh, a staff writer for Time. I'm pleased to welcome him back to our show today. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm okay. Has anything significant happened at the conference so far?
So far, not really. I mean, the first day was marked with a lot of speeches, opening ceremony. I believe there were concerts as well, mostly just statements from both delegates and the Danes who were leading the conference, talking about the importance of seizing this moment, really, to, while the world's attention is on this, to really deal with climate change and really do as much as possible towards getting a deal done now, today, and then over the next couple of weeks, you'll start to get into the nitty-gritty negotiation, and those, you know, the good feelings you have at the beginning will sort of begin to disappear as people really start to hit up against diplomatic limits.
Although it was announced yesterday that this would be the warmest decade on record, and there were news reports on the Maldives making plans to evacuate its population if the sea level continues to rise. Are they intended, do you think, to help spur progress in the negotiations?
Well, certainly. I mean, every time we have one of these major summits, you often get a lot of scientific information coming out at the same time. I mean, those numbers were coming from the World Meteorological Organization. They are the UN's record keeper when it comes to this, and so they know that. But I think also there's a sense that, yes, they need to put this out there and make sure people are aware of this to add to the public a momentum towards doing something about climate change. And there may be a bit as well sort of responding to some of the controversies that have arisen over those hacked emails that came from the East Anglia University in Britain that raised doubts among some people's minds as to whether the scientific question about climate change was fully settled.
How damaging do you think that information is? Has it hurt the case for climate change?
Well, from a scientific perspective, no. I mean, it at this point, it's still unclear exactly, because these emails were taken out of context, and there's still now an investigation ongoing at the university to try to determine what's going on here. Certainly, some of the statements out of there made the scientists seem, I mean, they seem a bit more human, really. But ultimately, you look at the overwhelming scientific consensus, the work of thousands of scientists over decades now, and it still overwhelmingly points towards the fact that global warming is real, it's mostly caused by man-made fossil fuel emissions, and it is dangerous. However, politically, certainly the timing for this couldn't have been worse, and it did give those who are skeptical about this, or those who are really doubtful about our ability to deal with this in an economically viable way, gave them a lot of ammunition. You've seen some polls of Americans recently that seems to indicate that there is a rise in general skepticism towards global warming at the very point when we're actually close to doing something about it.
The Kyoto Protocol expires in 2012, and so any agreement reached at Copenhagen would seem to be an extension of that. Haven't countries struggled to reach the goals that they set in signing the Kyoto Protocol?
Some countries have struggled to do so, and some won't meet them altogether. In fact, Canada actually has already said that they're not going to come close to meeting it. But other countries.
But weren't they kind of modest?
They were. I mean, some of them were modest. I mean, Canada actually had to take stronger cuts because some of the countries varied in terms of the cuts they took on. Some countries have been successful in meeting them. It looks like France, Britain will meet them. I think Germany will as well. Others, including Denmark, which is the host country here, it seems unlikely to meet their targets. And what people will tell you is that, I mean, the Kyoto Protocol was a very incomplete treaty. You can't really deal effectively with climate change and leave out the United States, of course, which ultimately did not ratify it, but also ultimately developing countries, major developing countries like China and India were not part of that. So in the absence of that, you had an incomplete treaty. I think people are hopefully looking at this as sort of a first phase, a test phase, and there is some evidence now that carbon trading and some of the other means, the tools behind this, as these countries got more experience with it, became a bit more successful in being able to meet those goals. And hopefully, in a new treaty or an extension treaty, you'll be able to do that even better because you will have that experience.
So some of the problems of Kyoto will be fixed in this treaty, at least people hope. What's the goal of an agreement at Copenhagen? Is it really tied to the stated target of getting global temperatures within 2 degrees Celsius of pre-industrial levels?
Ultimately, that is the ultimate goal for everything we're working on here, and that goes back to the back to 1992 and the Earth Summit then, which sort of began the UN and these 190 nations on the road to dealing with climate change. The idea to avoid dangerous climate change, and that's been, scientists have more or less said that they picked the 2 degrees Celsius target as a good marker, that above this it starts to get really scary. Copenhagen, the expectations for this have been rolled back. I mean, a year ago, there was great hope that you would have an actual treaty actually worked out, actually signed, and then to be able to be sent to member nations after Copenhagen for approval. That's not going to happen now. At this point, what they're looking for is a political agreement, which could be really as simple as just saying, you know, we the nations of the world, believe in climate change and need to deal something about it. And then as much as possible, put the architecture for a larger treaty in place with the hope that next year, hopefully very soon next year, when the U.S., first of all, actually accepts carbon caps of its own, then we can put those numbers in, sign it, and hopefully get this going in time to supplement the Kyoto Protocol when it does expire in 2012.
Well, yesterday, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced that greenhouse gases pose a public health danger and that they need to be regulated. Does that announcement change the outlook for the next 2 weeks?
Ultimately, not really. I mean, that announcement was in the works for some time, and it still doesn't give the U.S. what it really needs, which is Senate approval of carbon caps. Of course, any treaty that's negotiated, Copenhagen or any other treaty, of course, needs Senate approval. Obama has been very clear about he wants the Senate to go forward, say what levels of carbon caps they're willing to accept, then allow his negotiators to finish off and finally sell that. The EPA ruling doesn't change that. It does offer some more momentum. It does give some ammunition to American diplomats and to Obama himself when he goes at the end of next week and say, look, we are taking this seriously. But the truth is that it's still fairly unclear exactly what the EPA will be doing this. They talk about the need to put best available technology on, say, new power plants or factories when it comes to dealing with carbon. But the truth is, we're not really sure what that is often. I mean, does that mean no more coal plants, of course, because coal plants emit a lot of carbon? That's not clear right now. That still needs to be worked out. And they've been saying they would really prefer a law to top-down EPA regulation.
Well, is it likely to run into the same kind of resistance in the Senate that the Kyoto Protocol did in the 1990s? Or do you think that public opinion has shifted enough to force some of those reluctant people in Congress to change their vote?
I think public opinion has changed quite a bit. The Kyoto Protocol was never actually put forward to the Senate, but there was a resolution rejecting the terms of the Kyoto Protocol, mostly with the concern that major developing countries weren't required to do anything. And that, of course, that won 95-0 in the Senate. But now there's a lot of confidence that you have a solid number of Democrats in the Senate who will support cap and trade. And hopefully you'll be able to get a few Republicans. Of course, you need those 60 votes to get a law passed. And it seems as if we're close, but it would be a very close call. And certainly there's going to be a lot of opposition. And we've seen that on the Senate at hearings. We've seen that in the House as well. So it's going to be a tough road to go for anyone who wants to push that through.
Well, President Obama met with former Vice President Al Gore in the Oval Office yesterday. I'm assuming that's another way of sending signals. The U.S. made a proposal in the lead-up to the conference, a 30% reduction from 2005 emission levels by 2025, 42% by 2030, and more than 80% by 2050. How has that proposal been received?
Oh, I think actually it was 17% below 2005 levels by 2020, so it was a little bit less ambitious than that. And that's been received. On one hand, this is the first time a U.S. president will be coming to a major environmental summit with targets in hand, while saying, yes, we are willing to cap carbon. We believe in this. I mean, this has never happened before. Al Gore was not able to do that when he took part in the Kyoto Protocol back in the 90s. At the same time, the European Union has committed itself to a much deeper cuts, at least 20% below 1990 levels by 2020. And so they look at what the U.S. is doing, and they rightfully say, well, it's not quite there yet. I mean, this is nowhere near what we need, what scientists tell us to really avert the greatest risk of serious climate change. And it's quite unfair that we ourselves are taking on these very heavy targets, and you, the United States, coming very late to this party after 8 years of nothing happening under the Bush administration, and not be willing to put forward more ambitious targets.
I'm talking with Brian Walsh, staff writer for Time Magazine, about the Copenhagen summit, and we have links to his articles on climate Change Summit on our show page at WNYC.org. President Obama had been scheduled to arrive in Copenhagen tomorrow, but over the weekend, the White House announced that he wouldn't be visiting the conference until the last day on December 18th. Do you know why the timing of the trip was changed?
Well, certainly all the important negotiations, all the important work happens in the second half of a summit like this, usually actually towards the end of the second half. Diplomats are liking to go up against deadlines. So if Obama had showed up tomorrow, he could have given a speech, but the real momentum wouldn't have been there. No other world leaders would have been there. No environmental ministers would have been there. So by moving his presence to the end, it does give a little more credence to the idea that we should feel hopeful about this, that the White House believes that an effective deal or an effective agreement, at the very least, can come out of Copenhagen. Otherwise, I don't think they would like to put the president in that position if these talks are destined to fall apart at the end.
And he's just one of 110 heads of government and heads of state that are scheduled to attend the summit, which would suggest that the world is paying more attention to this summit than they did in Kyoto in 1997.
Absolutely. I mean, you really do get the sense that this is a moment here, that world leaders are willing to put some of their reputations on the line by showing up here. Of course, at the same time, it does sort of indicate that expectations have been dropped back a bit. If we're really at the teeth and nails of a negotiation, trying to get absolute targets set, an absolute treaty here, the risk of failure would be greater. You might not see so many world leaders now. Since they know going in that that's not the ultimate goal of this particular meeting, they can go in, give certain speeches about the importance of dealing with climate change, and not worry that the whole thing is going to fall apart. Of course, that could still happen in the future. I mean, that could still happen in whatever the following meeting that will be scheduled to hopefully hammer out the last details here.
Well, on top of those 110 leaders of government, we have 15,000 delegates at the IPCC. What happens at these conferences besides negotiating about greenhouse gases? Do they act as fora for scientists to announce findings?
Absolutely. I mean, that's often the case. You have what are called side events, and those. This is basically one gigantic conference. This is the biggest environmental conference possibly ever. So you have environmentalists that will be doing side events, sometimes technical, on issues like deforestation, climate finance, usually for the benefit of journalists, but also other delegates there as well. You'll have a lot of protests, often quite colorful, a lot of civil actions. In fact, I know the government of Denmark is fairly concerned about the risk of more violent protests later on next week. They're sort of preparing for that. It has a mix of a festival atmosphere, a scientific conference, and a hard-nosed political one all at the same time.
Well, China has made a proposal that reduces emissions per dollar of economic output. What does that mean for a country that's expected to see major economic growth in the coming years? Could it still mean an increase in emissions overall?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, China is not going to be agreeing to emission reductions or emission cap anytime soon as their economy keeps growing 8 to 9 to 10% a year. So will carbon. And this agreement or pledge that they've made involves saying that they promise to improve their energy efficiency. In other words, to get more economic value per unit of carbon they emit. And that's really what they're being asked to do. I mean, no one's really expecting the major developing countries to yet cap their carbon emissions. At the same time, this means their emissions will continue to go up. I mean, I've seen numbers that indicate even with this pledge, you could see Chinese emissions doubling by 2030 or so. And that's a country that's already the world's top carbon emitter. So they need to be able to get on themselves on a path as soon as possible to decarbonizing. And hopefully this pledge is just the first step in putting themselves on that.
And then there are other developing countries like Brazil, South Africa, and India. What are they hoping to get from an agreement in Copenhagen? Didn't they all sign Kyoto? Did that have much of an impact on the way they proceeded?
They did sign Kyoto, and in terms of the impact that had on them is that it made them eligible for early carbon financing under something called the Clean Development Mechanism, where developed nations that signed on to Kyoto, say European countries or Japan, could offset some of their emissions effectively by investing in carbon-reducing technologies in developing countries. In this case, actually, China took home the vast majority of that, as they do most foreign investment. But those other countries were looking to that as well. And specifically for Brazil, for instance, which is a major forest country, of course, with the rainforests, their interest in signing on to this is that they could possibly tap billions in finance if we see something called RED, or reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation, being part of this next treaty. That would basically allow developed countries to offset their emissions by paying, say, a tropical nation like Brazil to keep its rainforests alive, keep them going. And for a nation, of course, like that has the Amazonian rainforest, that could be an enormous amount of funding. So they do want to be part of that.
Well, India has refused to sign any legally binding targets, but it is among the nations that proposed emission goals ahead of the summit. So I assume that's significant. A listener wants to know if there is a consensus on nuclear power that's emerging at Copenhagen.
I don't think there is a consensus necessarily on that. That's not likely to be a part of it. I mean, those sort of individual energy choices by individual countries, that's something that's likely to be kept separate. Of course, there's a wide range of disagreement on that. You have a country like France in Europe that is primarily powered by nuclear and wants to keep that going. Then you have a country like Germany where there's a strong anti-nuclear civil force, and they're actually possibly decommissioning their own nuclear power plants. So I think we have to understand that that's almost certainly going to be part of any agreement or part of any need to decarbonize the world's energy supply, but that's likely to be put forward in a different forum.
Is there value in the Copenhagen summit if it doesn't yield an agreement, or if some of the major players don't sign? For example, if the U.S. Senate balks at an agreement?
Ultimately, if the U.S. Senate does balk at an agreement, if they either vote down cap and trade, which would make a final treaty almost impossible to put forward, or if in the end a treaty does go forward and then somehow it doesn't pass the Senate, no, I mean, ultimately, we cannot have a repeat of the Kyoto process. You cannot have the rest of the world continue to go on absent the U.S. It's a major carbon emitter. It's a major source of funding. If any agreement goes forward without the U.S., or for that matter, without the more direct participation of major developing countries like China and India, ultimately it has to be viewed as a failure.
Thank you so much for talking with us again, Brian Walsh, staff writer for Time magazine.
Thank you very much.